We're learning about the physician support line on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, glad you could be here. So this is a nationwide free and confidential support line made up of hundreds of volunteer psychiatrists providing peer support to physicians and med students. Doctors, they're already in a high-stress profession, but a study published last year by Cambridge University found COVID has put physicians at greater risk for distress and called for ways to reduce mental health stigma in clinical workplaces. Physicians, allow us to walk in your shoes here. What can you say about the stress you're experiencing? How do you cope? 800-642-1234. Dr. Mona Massoud is founder and chief organizer of the Physician Support Line. She's a psychiatrist in the Philadelphia area. Dr. Massoud, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate, for having me.
Your helpline, you launched it in March of 2020, which very much aligns with the early days of the pandemic. What observations have you made about this support tool as we go through these times?
So we started in March of 2020, right as the pandemic hit our shores. And it's interesting, the evolution of support that we've deemed necessary for physicians and medical students since the beginning of the pandemic. And it really has, you know, encompassed not only our own worries about living up to the expectations of being heroes, which is something that was an early trope, an early kind of description of the work that we were doing. And our feelings, our very inner, real, raw feelings that we were not going to be able to live up to that expectation. And that kind of, is the overarching feeling that physicians and healthcare workers tend to have, that we are trying our best to deliver care and live up to the Hippocratic Oath. But in the end, we are human too. We are susceptible to the virus. We are also susceptible to burnout and to moral injury.
My guess is there's not a typical call, but maybe you have seen some patterns emerge as you look at the evolution of support. Can you walk us through what a call might be like with a physician?
Yes. So it's interesting because doctors, we find, will call when they have a free minute. They're often, in the middle of rounds, or they're in the possibly seeing an ICU patient, or they're on call. Sometimes they're on their, third back-to-back shift because of staff shortages, and they're just had to pick up because they're the only healthy person there who hasn't contracted COVID. Some are calling us on their drive home because the only time that they don't have somebody around them that needs them, whether it's family, whether it's patients. So it's just when a physician's even calling us has so much nuance to it. And then what they call about, sometimes it'll be, I just need to feel grounded right now. I just got yelled at by a patient who is understandably frustrated, but I don't know how to deal with that frustration best directed at me. Or they'll call us about their own frustrations of unvaccinated patients coming in, but they can't say anything in the workplace. So they kind of have to vent to us. Some talk about their family struggles and not feeling enough of a parent, enough of a spouse, because all their time and energy is being taken up by taking care of other people.
My guess is there's a lot of listening going on in these phone calls, but what might the psychiatrist say? What might their peers say to them that could help in some way?
It's amazing because the culture of medicine, and even amongst physicians, is stiff upper lip, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, get over it. Your job here is to, is a one-way street where you take care of others. You know, asking for help or admitting that you even need help is, even within the medical culture, a huge stigma. And so what we're trying to do with peer support is giving each other permission to to talk about our own wellness and to prioritize our wellness. And it's amazing when you can hear it from someone who has the same shared experience of medicine, who sat through the same exams, who has seen the same types of patients and knows implicitly what it's like to walk in these shoes. It's just for someone on the line who is a physician to say, you know, that's normal, right? You know, you can feel that, right? And just that permission does wonders for people.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with the founder of the National Physician Support Line. This is a peer-to-peer support line available 7 days a week to physicians and medical students. Dr. Mona Massoud is with us, founder of the support line. You can join in. Are you a physician or on the healthcare team? What would you like people to know about your daily stresses? Where have you turned to for support? And did you feel like you could reach out? Join in at 800-642-1234. I understand there has been an increase in calls from physicians related to the reduced isolation guidelines from the CDC from 10 days to 5 days after testing positive. What are you hearing from physicians about the reduced isolation time and what stress that is causing?
I mean, it's definitely adding on to this already, this, whether you call it burnout or moral injury, but also this feeling that's kind of been pervasive about, again, this hero's narrative. You know, we feel a bit of betrayal because from the public, we were being called heroes at one point, and then we were turned kind of into villains after the vaccines and the, you know, the ongoing mistrust of health policy right now. And then speaking of policy, then when we have, you know, the CDC, which at one part of our intellectual minds, we understand the evolution of guidelines in a pandemic. But in the other part of us, which is very human and having to live the consequences of quick changes in policy, it's really disheartening. We feel often that we're kind of a sacrificial lamb, whether by the public or by public health in terms of the ongoing pandemic. Us coming back early is also heavy on our moral consciousness of being physicians, where we don't want to do harm. And we worry that, you know, not only are we being asked to come back while we may be sick and that's harming us because we may be sick, but also that are we going to inadvertently spread this thing, like the same thing we're trying to prevent? So it has so many different layers that have been weighing on physicians.
We have been hearing the voices of healthcare professionals who have full hospital beds, who are, you know, having people in the ER who are spending 30 hours maybe waiting for help. One of the people on the healthcare team, and I'm going to share just a moment here, is from a Madison-based nurse, Mariah Clark, who kept audio diaries. And this is after an overnight shift in the ER in March 2021.
I've definitely lost count of how many patients I've lost. And I know that nobody who didn't deal with COVID day in and day out, constantly faced with it in all of its ugly truth, is gonna ever really grasp what it was like.
Dr. Massoud, when you hear those types of words, deeply personal, how do you think about the moral injury and what is moral injury?
Oh gosh, yeah, absolutely. To start off with the definition of moral injury, which I feel is a more accurate framework regarding burnout, which is a common term everyone keeps using, you know, I'm burnt out. Moral injury is specific to our imminent anxiety about our morality, our moral compass, which it happens quite a lot in people who are public servants, where the job is not just a job contract. It is really a moral calling. And this includes, you know, people who are servicemen and women. It includes healthcare workers. It includes other frontline people who literally deal with life and death situations and have to have a very strong moral and ethical calling to their profession. And what moral injury is when that calling gets compromised by factors that are beyond our control. That, for example, for physicians and healthcare workers, we have the knowledge to take care of our patients. Mm. We have the training. We have, to a degree, signed up for this, as people keep telling us. But what we did not sign up for is exactly what we just heard this nurse say, exactly what thousands now of physicians and medical students have said on the support line. We have not signed up to be stretched so thin with resources that we have to tell our patients, I know what I can do for you, but I can't do it for you because we don't have enough vents. We don't have room for you. And to be able to be the deliverer of this kind of news over and over, it is incredibly helpless, and it really feels like a burden upon our moral conscience.
Psychiatrist Mona Massoud founded Physician Support Line. Healthcare workers, do you have access to mental health resources? Do you feel comfortable reaching out? Healthcare executives, what have you done to change the climate at your hospital or clinic for physicians to feel okay with getting support? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Massoud here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing a peer support line for physicians on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nationwide physician support line is a safe space for physicians to discuss their immediate stresses, calling up a volunteer psychiatrist colleague uniquely trained in mental wellness. Physicians on the healthcare team, do you have access to mental health resources? And how often is it discussed among you and your colleagues? Does your hospital make it easy to reach out for help? Are you aware of this support line or other resources? Join in 800-642-1234. Psychiatrist Mona Massoud founded Physician Support Line, and she's with us for 9 more minutes. Dr. Massoud, let's talk about medical licenses. Nearly 40% of physicians said they are reluctant to get mental health care out of concern over their license, and that is from a 2017 paper in Mayo Clinic Proceedings. What is the issue in this area?
Yes. So, of course, we have the individual burnout, moral injury, and medical culture that you and I have just discussed that is a barrier to mental health seeking. But then, as most things, we have systemic barriers to mental health seeking amongst physicians. And one of them is the barrier present in state medical licensing applications. So the way that it works for our listeners, the way that it works is that we don't have one medical licensing board for the entire United States. It's all governed by individual states. And so what happens there is that each application has its own its own questions and its own questions it finds relevant. And one of those questions that has been pervasive throughout these applications has been mental health questions. And they can be pervasive and invasive in what they ask for. And where this arises from and what these mental health questions ask is like, have you sought therapy? Have you even sought medicine? Were you ever hospitalized for mental health reasons? Were you ever in any sort of programs for mental health reasons? And at the surface, they may seem like a relevant question to ask physicians, especially because all of us, including physicians, do not want what we term an impaired physician. Which is a person who is, something is going on that is getting in the way of them providing standard of care to their patients. None of us want that. But what has inadvertently happened with these questions is that there has been a blurred line between what is an impaired physician and what is a patient who is just taking care of their health. And that is worrisome because mental health carries such a stigma that has become so implicit that even in these medical licensing, they don't realize what it is doing, and what it has done, and the consequences of this has been so detrimental that physicians will either, if they do absolutely deserve and need mental health care because they are human and they've gone through postpartum depression or they've gone through complicated grief or they're having post-traumatic reaction, especially now with the pandemic. All of these things are very valid human concerns that we want people to take care of. But the choices that are left for physicians in tackling mental health in medical licensing boards is either I disclose that I got care for this and then risk having a microscope on me throughout my practice in the state. And there are all of a sudden you will have, you know, you have to come for these meetings or you have to check in with this person. And then it becomes kind of guilty until found innocent kind of proceedings. Hmm. Or it becomes, I don't say anything and I lie. And then what happens if you get caught? What consequences does that have? And the consequences then are not just mild. This is losing of a medical licensing, losing not only of your profession and being able to work as a physician, but losing really the fact that to become a physician in the United States, there is so much that went into it. This mm-hmm. is a high stakes field. You have gone through years and years of training. And then you have also invested a lot of student loans, and you are paying off those loans, and they're hundreds of thousands of dollars, which again, physicians will not talk about.
The practices then of these medical licensing boards, what I'm hearing you say is that the practices might deter physicians from, you know, even saying anything or that being, because it might hurt their career or their reputation, their promotability. Mm-hmm. It might yes. even put their license at stake.
Oh, absolutely. And at this point, and when you do something hours and hours, we can't even accumulate the amount of hours we spent in this this field. It becomes about identity. It really, really does. We internalize this not only as a profession, but really as a calling, as an identity. It becomes really part of us. And when you start getting into that field psychologically, when you start saying that, you know, you are at risk of losing something that is so crucial to how you identify yourself, then you start risking very severe mental health issues, including physician suicide, which is one of the highest of all professions.
I just want to reintroduce you. We're talking with Dr. Mona Massoud, founder and chief organizer of the Physician Support Line. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's go to Lauren now in Burlington. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. I didn't realize I was going to be on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yes.
No, that's okay. I'll make it very quick. I'm a mental health counselor. I know I get a lot of support from my coworkers. And that's actually very encouraged in our sector. I also see a therapist on the side, and a lot of us also do that. My question for the doctor is, if is going to a peer support group that is not organized by a professional therapy or psychiatry organization, in other words, they're not having to pay for it, that's like a community support group, say like through NAMI or whatever, would that be considered seeking mental health under those licensing requirements that you were talking about a little while ago? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Lauren.
Sure. Great question. It depends. Again, it's about what is being and there's a gray zone. So thank you, Lauren, because this is a nuance that physicians navigate and other people navigate all the time. There is not, I don't believe you have to disclose something like that. I don't also believe, I think physicians also have navigated their mental health oftentimes by taking it out of their insurer or anything that can be traced. And I don't know how relevant that is, but I do know that physicians do that. Anything that feels that it can be traced back to them is something that they stay away from. And just as a comment, as an aside on peer support, even if it's not run by professionals or it's not run something that is traceable, I do encourage people who are listening today to find peer support, because the shared experience that we were describing earlier is so crucial of not having to explain yourself, is what these doctors calling the support line always say. I don't have to defend myself. I don't even have to. I'm just talking to someone who gets it, and we can just get into it without having to justify my need for support right now. And so all of you listening that are maybe hesitant for seeking, a psychiatrist or a therapist, or are just very unfamiliar with how support or emotional support or mental health even works, try peer support first. Join groups. We have that through social media or in person. So as an aside, I do encourage peer support.
Dr. Masood, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kate, for having me.
Dr. Mona Masood, founder of the Physician Support Line, the number 888-409-0141. That's 888-409-0141. News update is next on the Ideas Network. A quick programming note. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us for the morning show. Join us here on the Ideas Network for special programming on Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday. It is a rebroadcast of the 2021 official Wisconsin celebration and tribute hosted by WPR's Dr. Jonathan Overby. That's Monday at noon. Find out more at WPR.org. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy to tell us about a rivalry between the late popular advice columnists Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren.
Legendary advice columnist Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren dished out wise and witty advice to millions of readers for more than half a century. The two were also twins and sometimes bitter rivals. But before they were famous, they lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin for more than a decade. Dean Robbins brings you the story of the sisters who perhaps could have used some advice themselves.
Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren were America's leading advice columnists from the 1950s into the 21st century. Dear Abby was the world's most widely syndicated newspaper column with 110 million readers. Ask Ann Landers wasn't far behind with 90 million. Each writer solved other people's problems, answering letters with homespun wisdom. However, their own problems, with each other, proved harder to solve. Ann and Abby became bitter professional rivals, but once upon a time, they were inseparable twin sisters, raising families a mile away from each other in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Born Pauline and Eppie Friedman in Sioux City, Iowa in 1918, they grew up doing everything together. They even had a double wedding in identical dresses and veils. In the 1940s, the twins moved to Eau Claire, where both of their husbands had jobs at the National Presto Appliance Company. Pauline and Eppie cut glamorous figures in their new community. They hosted elaborate parties, volunteered for local charities, and led parades in a Cadillac convertible. They also loved to watch the Eau Claire Bears baseball team at Carson Park, turning heads with their lacquered hairstyles. But by the end of their decade in Eau Claire, cracks appeared in the sisters' relationship. Pauline and her millionaire husband lived in a stately two-story, while Eppie and her poorer husband had a small two-bedroom that Pauline dubbed Peanut Place. They even began trading insults about each other's daughters. The stage was set for a blow-up, and it happened shortly after the twins left Eau Claire in 1954. First, Eppie took over the Ann Landers advice column at the Chicago Sun-Times. A mere 3 months later, Pauline jumped into the advice biz herself, starting Dear Abby under the pen name Abigail Van Buren at the San Francisco Chronicle. Eppie saw it as a hostile gesture, and the sisters stopped speaking. In 1958, a Life magazine article gave them a national platform for their quarrel. She wanted to be the first violin in the school orchestra, Pauline sneered,
but I was. Epi retorted, she's just like a kid who beats a dog until somebody looks and then starts petting it. Ouch. The magazine declared it the most feverish female feud since Elizabeth sent Mary, Queen of Scots, to the chopping block. The dueling advice columnists reconciled in 1964, but hard feelings remained. In a 1979 TV appearance, Epi claimed she never read Dear Abby. In a magazine interview 2 years later, Pauline mocked Epi as envious and inferior. For good measure, she said her twin looked old. Ouch again. Epi died in 2002 and Pauline in 2013, concluding the saga of Ann Landers versus Abigail Van Buren. You have to wonder if, at the end of their lives, they pined for the innocent pleasures of Eau Claire. Yes, both had become wildly successful since their time in Wisconsin, hailed as America's most influential women. But would they have traded all that to be back in Carson Park, arm in arm, blissfully cheering the Bears baseball team?
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to the Milwaukee Bucks play-by-play. Recognize this broadcaster?
Middleton's got 13 here in the fourth. Gives it up to Giannis. That's been your 1-2 punch! Speaking of punch, Giannis throws it home!
That is the voice of Lisa Byington, the Bucks TV play-by-play announcer on Bally Sports Wisconsin, which is the TV home for the Bucks. She took the seat of Jim Paschke, who retired after 35 years. What do you want to ask a color commentator? What have you wondered about play-by-play announcing? It's 800-642-1234. Here are some notes about Lisa's career. She's been a play-by-play announcer for the Tokyo Olympics, NCAA men's basketball tournaments, the Women's World Cup. She was behind the mic for her first regular season Bucks game in October. Lisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, when any woman breaks the proverbial glass ceiling, there's always a spotlight on how she got around that invisible barrier, and it even overshadows the actual work she did to land that job. So the fact that you're the first female full-time play-by-play broadcaster for a major men's professional sports team, that was the headline. But what can you tell us about your career trajectory and how you honed your craft of being a play-by-play broadcaster?
Well, I think the first thing is that you don't go about things thinking that you're going to be the first to do this or trying to break barriers. You pursue a passion, you pursue a job because it's what you want to do. And I've always said that my two parents, they're both educators, my mom and my dad. And so they're always about educating myself and my older sister. And when I was young, you know, I would go out and at recess, and sometimes I would be the only girl playing soccer at recess with the boys. But I never thought twice about it because that's what I wanted to do. And so my parents instilled in me in a really young age that you don't do things. There are no barriers based on gender. If you want to go do something, you go do something. And so that's how I've pursued my professional career. Everything from working at local news to eventually getting to the network level to now working in the NBA. All of those steps and those changes and the progression that I've made is just believing that you could do something, not because you're a woman or a man. It's just because you want to do it. And so that's how I've gone about my life.
But play-by-play, that is a whole other beast. That takes a lot of skill, especially in the moment skill. How did you know that you wanted to do that? And then how did you get those skills?
I didn't know for a long time. So I grew up playing sports, and I played two sports at the Division I level. I was recruited to Northwestern University to play basketball there for 4 years, and then I also walked onto the soccer team. So quite honestly, Kate, when I watched the a broadcast or a sporting event on TV, I always thought that I could be the athlete playing in those sports. I was never watching those games with the ear of listening to the broadcasters, because you never think that you need that real job, right? When you're in high school and when you're in college, you don't think about the real world at all. And so I never really thought about what I was going to do until maybe like my junior year in college, when I realized, okay, Lisa, you probably can't play sports for your entire life. So you got to figure out what you want to do. And quite frankly, at the time, I was thinking about studio hosting, and the show Sports Center on ESPN was such a big thing back then when I was a little kid growing up. And so I always envisioned myself as kind of a Sports Center anchor. It wasn't until later that actually a boss came to me and proposed to me the idea of doing a play-by-play game, and it was for a women's basketball game. It was Michigan State against Indiana. I happened to be a local reporter at the time in Lansing, Michigan, so I was right there, and so the timing was good, and it was for the Big Ten Network, and so I tried it, liked it, wasn't very good at the beginning, but I tried it, liked it, and it was really was at that point that I thought, you know what, I really like this skill, I like this job, and so that was kind of the turning point for me, is when I started doing stuff for Big Ten Network, is I started now watching games and sporting events with a broadcaster's ear, and I had never done that before. So, and to this day, I can always joke with people that I'm working, right, when I listen to a sporting event, because I'm listening to the back and forth with the broadcasters and stuff. So what a great job to have, right, where you can say that you're actually doing homework watching a sporting event.
One Bucks blogger called your style fair and objective. How do you walk that line between opinion and objectivity during a play-by-play commentary?
Well, you know, I've been, you know, sports has been my whole life, and it's not, I don't look at it really as my job to do a whole lot of judging, you know. I work with the analyst and whoever it is, the color commentator who I'm working with, it's really kind of their job to say why things aren't working or why things are working. It's my job to maybe set them up in that way. And, you know, you always want to give teams, situations, kind of the benefit of the doubt. I've always kind of thought that for my role, that's what my role is. And so I appreciate that. I appreciate that people listen and watch and think that my broadcaster presentation is very fair, because that's the way I kind of approach it. So and of course, to have a little bit of fun as well. But the opinions, I think those are a lot of those are for the analyst role, and opinions are for kind of like the studio shows that you see that kind of give an opinion on coaches and players and stuff. And I really don't view that as my role at all.
What does your desktop look like during a game? What can you give us a picture?
My desktop.
Like what is around you during a game? Yes. And the tools that you're using as you call a game.
That's a good question. So to my left is always a statistician. They will kind of keep me honest with some things and scoring runs or even droughts. You know, if we're approaching a milestone, you know, they'll keep me honest with that kind of stuff, foul situations, whatever. And so finding a good statistician, and I have one in BJ Cronus that I've worked with in all the home games, so I'll give him a shout out. He's been great. To my right is the analyst. Marcus Johnson is our lead analyst, and Stephen Bardo has filled in sometimes for Marcus Johnson. And then next to Marcus is our stage manager, Leon Darun, and he's been great too. And so he kind of organizes things and makes sure that we know when we have our on cameras. He makes sure that we look nice and presentable when we do our on cameras. So you really have four people kind of sitting in a very small sort of broadcast table. In front of me, I have my broadcast boards, and I spent hours on those. And so to the left of on my boards is really the opponent, and to the right of my boards is the Milwaukee Bucks stuff. And what I have on my boards are everything from what college they played at, how many years they've been in the NBA, little nuggets, human interest nuggets, just different stats and that sort of thing. And then in front of me, I have my iPad, which is connected to the actual stats of the game. So it's live stats that continue to update. And so you're just kind of navigating through your notes, through the stats, through promos, through listening to your analyst. Also, you know, you've got your producer kind of chiming in your headset. And so a play-by-play really has to juggle a lot, and I'm not sure a lot of people realize how many voices and how many things you're kind of handling at the moment.
Oh, a lot going on. Milwaukee Bucks play-by-play announcer Lisa Byington giving us a peek into her world behind the mic calling the games. Are you a Bucks fan? How do sports journalists change your experience while watching a game? Where do you think the Bucks are headed this year, by the way? What questions do you have for a sports journalist who's covered everything from college football to the Olympics? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Lisa Byington here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're in conversation with Milwaukee Bucks play-by-play broadcaster Lisa Byington, the Bucks' first female to have this job. Have you ever tried play-by-play announcing? What was most challenging or rewarding about it? Do you dream of becoming a professional sports broadcaster? What questions do you have about that career path? Still time, 800-642-1234. Lisa Byington with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Lisa, what we're hearing from you is doing play-by-play is very different than, say, doing feature sports stories or being a sideline reporter on the field. Can you kind of give us a sense of what is so different about those other types of sports journalism?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've done all those other jobs as well. You know, I think the biggest thing with being a play-by-play is you're one of the main soundtracks of the game, and you're broadcasting the game live. If you're doing features on someone, you have the luxury of editing things. You know, you don't have the luxury of editing out what you say during a live broadcast. But when you're doing a feature and you're sitting down with someone and interviewing them, you have the time. You have the time to put that piece together. Sideline reporting, it's I kind of equate it to getting off on the exit of a highway. You got to get off in time and then, you know, be able to get back on the highway. There's usually, you know, small updates that you do as a sideline reporter from anywhere from 20 seconds to 40 seconds. And then that's your role. You have to get in and out of things. Sideline reporting is a version of kind of feature reporting, but it's also a version of observation reporting. What you see with from the bench or from the huddles, if we're talking about the sport of basketball, interactions that you hear, the back and forth of that. You have to be kind of the eyes and the ears on the court or on the field as a sideline reporter, that you have access and you can get closer maybe to the team than, let's say, necessarily a play-by-play or an analyst could. So there's all those different kind of roles, and it's much, much different being a reporter versus being a play-by-play.
Last year, we had a conversation with Julie DeCaro of Deadspin about her book Sidelined, and it really drills down into sexism in sports and what it was like for her to be a sports radio anchor. And I remember we talked about post-game athlete interviews in the locker room and how male sports journalists can land those locker room interviews, walk right in, no problem. But for female colleagues, getting the scoop in the locker room is really toxic, or you have to wait outside. Can you share any insights there or on the obstacles that female sports journalists still contend with today?
Well, you know, the era of COVID is not changing that, right? Because no one gets in the locker room. So a lot of them are in a press conference room, or a lot of them are via Zoom. So maybe that's a situation or an issue that won't happen ever again. Maybe, you know, we're forever changing in that way. Hmm. I think it's just expectations. You know, it seems like when a woman is broadcasting sports, whatever role you might be, whether it be a sideline reporter or a play-by-play or an analyst, studio host even, I feel like there are different layers of the acceptance of that woman doing that role. Number one, I think you have to prove that you know what you're talking about. And then number two, after that, then people kind of maybe are evaluating what you sound like and in that role. And I never feel like necessarily more times than not that a man in that role has to prove that he knows what he's doing. I always feel like that's the layer that women have to kind of fight through or get through, is prove to me first that you know the sport or you know what you're talking about, and then I'll decide if I like you as a broadcaster. That's, I think, the biggest challenge that I have seen that has to be overcome here in the future.
Interesting. Yes. Do you see that happening? Do you see it changing?
Well, slowly, yeah. And, you know, and I think it will change as long as we have more women broadcasting sports in several different roles. And I think that's the thing that is changing, is you look at all the major professional sports, and whether it's for one game or whether it's broadcasting now for a team, myself and Kate Scott are able to do that for teams now in the NBA. But if you look at the five major professional sports across the country, and a lot of management have actually given way to either a woman doing play-by-play and or a woman being an analyst at any of those sports. Now, it might not be a consistent thing. It might be something where they do it, you know, one time kind of thing. But it's slowly but surely you're just opening up the doors. And, mm-hmm. and that's what I think we need to see is the opportunity, more women in those roles. And then once we see more women in those roles, then it becomes more normalized. And I've always said that the moment that we can have a female voice broadcasting a men's game and have it be background noise is when I know that we've arrived. And what I mean by that, Kate, is think about how many times that you might have a sporting event on in the you know, family room, the den, wherever you're listening to it, and you're not really paying that much attention to it. It's background noise mm-hmm. for you. But the second you hear a female voice doing a quote-unquote men's game, whether it's basketball or football or baseball or men's soccer, you name it, and I'm guilty of it as anyone, you kind of stop and you listen and you yes. try to figure out who's that female announcer mm-hmm. doing that game. So the second that we can stop whatever we're doing to try to figure out who that female announcer is doing that men's game, then I know that we've arrived.
Circling back to COVID for just a moment, your first home game at Pfizer Forum was in October. And since then, COVID numbers fluctuating. We're in a surge now. This season, fans are allowed back at Pfizer, masks required. How have you seen game time atmosphere change, the tenor change, the fans change over the course of the pandemic?
Well, I had to broadcast a lot of games last year at several different levels where there weren't any fans, mm-hmm. you know, so it's very much welcome to have fans back. And I appreciate some of the safety precautions that the Bucks and Five Star Forum are going through to make sure that we can continue right now to have fans during a pandemic. But the energy is still there. Five Star Forum is awesome. And it is the best home environment in the NBA. And the fans are so passionate about the Bucks, and I love it. Whether they had masks on at the beginning of the year or now when they have to wear masks, they just bring the passion, the noise, the emotion in the building. And so I've absolutely loved it, and especially loved it contrasting it with what it was last year, where it was basically almost broadcasting a practice, you know, with maybe a few fans in the stands.
Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Byington, Bucks TV play-by-play announcer on Bally Sports Wisconsin. Bally Sports Wisconsin, the TV home of the Bucks. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.